From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack.
Oh, hi, Megan Mack. We've got the script backwards there.
Sorry about that. Good job.
Probably it's my fall cold that just about everyone in this office is about to get, because microphones really like to grab onto germs. That's a pleasant way to start this podcast. And that's about the only lightness in this podcast. I think you're going to hear a lot of compelling stuff this week, but it's heavy. And it starts with the author of one of the hottest pieces in the country who joined us on Thursday to discuss it. Adam Serwer is a senior editor for the Atlantic Monthly, and his new piece is called The Nationalist Delusion. In the piece, Serwer points to data showing that working class Americans did not vote for Donald Trump. Working class whites did, but wealthier whites voted for Trump in even larger numbers. So the idea that economic anxiety was the main driver to Donald Trump is not exactly aligned with the facts.
Serwer traces the history of movements built on racial discrimination, only to be later disavowed by the very people who propped them up. It goes all the way back to Alexander Stevens, vice president of the Confederacy, who said in 1861 that the South was fighting to preserve the right to own black people as slaves. He said that whites were superior and that slavery was natural, but he later tried to walk that back. Let's listen.
This is one of my favorite sort of little discoveries in the piece, was that Stevens, you know, he blamed the crooked media, you know, for
it's always
for,
the media's
fault. Misquoting him. It's the media's fault. But, you know, Stevens, his rationalization of what happened was the beginning of, you know, what historians refer to as the Lost Cause, which was, you know, essentially a great propaganda campaign by former Confederates to persuade the country that the Civil War was not actually about slavery, that half the country had not actually fought for the cause of human bondage, and that it was about something else, states' rights, freedom as they understood it. Stevens says, you know, my own opinion is slavery as often expressed was that the institution was not the best or could not be made the best for both races. Looking to the advancement and progress of both physically and morally, it ought to be abolished. I mean, that sounds insane, but the point of the example is to show that even the most virulent bigots in American history, you know, this man who, you know, was part of an institution that betrayed the country in defense of human chattel slavery, later said that he didn't do any such thing or those weren't his reasons. And if it's possible for him to rationalize it, it's relatively simple for someone to rationalize a comparably lesser racist act.
And so let's go through some of those examples where people did exactly that. In the Jim Crow era, the oppressors were often able to claim that they were the ones being oppressed, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is really important. And in the book that I'm citing in the piece, There Goes My Everything, is really a remarkable document. It's by Jason Sokol, and who's a historian. And it really is incredible for sort of illustrating how white Southerners viewed the civil rights movement. And they saw it, particularly the federal government's involvement in protecting black rights, they saw it as a kind of fascism. They believed that the government was fascist and they were the ones being oppressed by the government, even though they themselves were upholding a racial caste system wherein black people had fewer rights than white people. And I think that that sort of inversion of events as experienced by those Southerners helps illustrate, again, these are people who are defending a racist caste system who in fact, do not think of themselves as racist. And when you read the book, there are just endless examples of people saying, I love black people, and they often use a word that I'm not going to use because obviously this is a public radio program. But, you know, they say they love black people and they don't have anything against them at all, but they just, you know, they don't want to go to school with them, or, you know, they don't want to eat with them, or, you know, and so this rationalization, which is sort of, you know, it's core to the American experience, right? I mean, our country is founded on the idea that we're all created equal, but in fact, it enshrined slavery in its constitution, obliquely, but it still did. And I think, you know, that contradiction is sort of at the root of this cognitive dissonance about racism, which is that to acknowledge racism is sort of to admit something ugly about ourselves, so we have to lie to ourselves about it.
And we see George Wallace, what he was saying in 1963 versus later in 1984. Tell us about that.
The interesting thing about George Wallace is that we have sort of historical record of his conversion. George Wallace started out as like an economic populist, and he lost in a Democratic primary against a segregationist. And you know, he vowed that he was not going to lose that way again. And so he became this sort of arch segregationist, and it, you know, made him a powerful political figure in Alabama for decades. And, you know, he famously declared segregation now, segregation forever. He ran for president on a segregationist platform. But by the time it's, you know, it's 1984 and he's being interviewed for PBS's Eyes on the Prize documentary, he's claiming, you know, it was not an antagonism towards black people. And that's what some people can't understand. White Southerners did not believe it was discrimination. They thought it was in the best interest of both races. And so you see, again, here's George Wallace, an avatar of state racial discrimination, a man who based his career on it, who consciously shifted from being a kind of New Dealer economic populist to a segregationist, saying that's not actually an accurate characterization of me. I'm not a racist at all. And all those people in the South who voted for me who, because of my segregationist platform, well, they aren't really racist either.
Let's stay on the subject of race. Danielle Ponder is a criminal defense attorney in Rochester, and she's also the lead singer of Danielle Ponder and the Tomorrow People. Her daily work helps inform her songwriting, and this week she played a sold-out show at the Little Theater, highlighting how her views on racial justice are threaded through her music.
In this clip, Ponder describes the way she sees the justice system targeting people of color. And if it's most widely reported on in places like Ferguson, Missouri, Ponder says it is happening in Western New York, too.
The thing that has probably just really, I'm going to say, hurt me the most was a 16-year-old kid that I had maybe about 4 months ago who spent the night in jail because he didn't have a light on his bike. And just seeing this 16-year-old come out Saturday morning for arraignment and just thinking, what is going on? You know, what is happening in the city that a 16-year-old kid should be in custody overnight because he didn't have a bell on his bike? But that isn't the first time I've seen it, but that was the youngest person that I've seen stopped for no bell on their bike. So this has happened frequently in the city of Rochester, and I think most people are not aware of it.
When you think about the idea of people coming in and taking a look at Rochester, do you think from your perspective in criminal defense that would be true in most or all cities in this country?
Yes, I think so, yeah.
And do you think that that has changed at all in recent years, whether it's since Ferguson or with more of an emphasis on these conversations nationally, has that changed at all?
I'm not sure. I think what happened in New York City with the NYCLU and looking at stop and frisk has definitely created a national conversation, as Ferguson as well. I'm not sure if it's changed. Looking from where I'm standing, I don't see much of a difference. We actually were just, a few of my colleagues were talking about how we are seeing more no bell on bikes or no light on bikes stop in our office. So I don't have the data to tell you whether or not that whether it has changed or not. But from my viewpoint, it seems like things are still the same.
What would your, and maybe you've had conversations with police officers. I mean, is it as simple as saying, think about what you're doing, think about the kind of consequences that come forward with putting a 16-year-old in jail overnight because of no bell or no light on a bike? I mean, do you have those kinds of conversations? Do you hear from officers who would say, you know, that they understand, or are they following the law to the letter? I mean, what are the kinds of conversations you have?
So let me just kind of expand on the 16-year-old that didn't have a light on
sure.
his bike. I did have the opportunity to speak to his mother, and his mother said that he said a swear word to the officer. So that's what led to him spending the night in jail. The biggest thing that I see is that an inability to de-escalate from the Rochester Police Department. A 16-year-old uses a swear word against you, which actually is not a crime, not illegal, and your reaction is to arrest him for a vehicle and traffic offense and have him spend the night in jail. And I just was watching a body cam the other day where an officer is following a young person who's being mouthy, because young people can be mouthy, following him, and almost the officer is acting like he's also 16, and the two of them are going back and forth. And it just always shocked me, why aren't you just walking away at this point? Because this person is doing nothing criminal. Having an attitude is not criminal. But I really believe they see African-American youth and Latino youth as inherently criminal. So talking back to them all of a sudden becomes a crime. A lot of the charges that we see in court, disorderly conducts or obstructing governmental administration, typically involve giving an attitude to an officer. And we don't live in a country where we say to our young people, if you give an attitude to an officer, you'll be arrested. That's not, you know, it's not illegal to have an attitude. So I think the inability to de-escalate seems to be one of the biggest problems. It seems that once officers become involved, situations escalate. And I think there has to be better training on how to defuse a situation.
Next, an earthquake in the Rochester suburbs of sorts. For the first time ever, the town of Pittsford will have a person of color on the town council. And it all goes back to racist flyers that started showing up on Pittsford driveways a year ago.
Those flyers called for making Rochester white again. Kevin Beckford is a man of color who decided to get involved in educating his town about the value of diversity. Then he decided to run for office. Last month, Beckford won. In this clip, he describes what it was like going door-to-door campaigning, occasionally seeing racism up close.
I believe Pittsford is so much more progressive today than it was, say, maybe years ago. But we did have some of that in the beginning during petitioning. And what's tough to, I would say, you really can't tell what's in someone's head, right? So I don't like going to motive, but I know, you know, because there's a limited representation of African Americans in Pittsford, in some cases, it's the first time a person of color is ringing someone's doorbell. And so when you don't have a lot of exposure experience, we go to stereotypes, whether it's informed by the media, news, or movies, but not from personal experience. So we were a little bit concerned in the beginning that the percentage of doors might not open as much. And so what we did is we put together a nice, good volunteer group of folks that always walked with me. And so what it did is it helped to dispel that sort of, if there was anybody that would have that concern, it provided an opening to get the door to open.
Is that a little sad, though, that you literally had to walk with white people to make sure that everyone would feel comfortable letting you come up to their door?
So I have to tell you that, and again, and what's tough is that as a person of color, right, as a minority, this is not a sprint, it's a marathon. So I have more reserves, and as most people of color do, to deal with the next situation that's around the corner. So did it bother me? Absolutely. But I have to say that the vast majority of people, I think, were okay. You know, sometimes it could have been because there was a man by himself coming to the door versus having a group. But, you know, certainly probably the one that was the most memorable, and it's a piece that Erica spoke to in the article. And in fact, the volunteer that day was my wife, so it was particularly painful that we were petitioning and the door opened up and the person, you know, signed, and then they were getting ready to go and get someone else in the house to sign because there were two people in the home. And as she was walking away, she said, "Well, at least I know I'm not being robbed." And my wife said, no, ma'am, we just need your signature." And it was painful. And I know my wife and I talked about that quite a bit. By the way, I'm in a suit at that time. It was at the end of my work day, so I was in my full suit. And I have to say it was troubling. But, you know, I tell you, I'm a really big believer in the human spirit and change. And so I believe that day we created a new data point for the woman that opened that door. And my hope is that that data point will serve as a new reminder the next time a person of color rings her doorbell that, you know, it could be someone that's coming for politics or coming for something else. And it increases that experience that we're much of what we think about today that's what we call racism has a lot to do with the lack of humanity and connecting. If you do not know somebody that's different than you, it's awfully hard to realize that we are not different. We all, you know, we're different in a lot of ways, but we also share the same ear. We want the best for our families. We want the best out of life. We want to coexist. Those things are very simple. Those are the common experiences that should connect us that sometimes is missing when we don't have a bubble that's big enough.
We had the chance to sit down with several people in the local refugee community, people who lived for years in squalid refugee camps before getting the chance to come to the United States. New York State is one of three states that accept the highest percentage of refugees, and some states like Hawaii and Delaware did not take in a single refugee in the past year.
This is Kar Nar, a refugee from Burma in Thailand. She's thriving in Rochester, but she had to work very hard to build a new life after leaving her family behind in the refugee camp.
I applied to come here when I was 70 years old. I wanted my whole family came together, but for some reason, my parents, they did not want to because they were worried that if they said, my father said, "Well, if you do not speak English, how can you go to America? You don't speak the language. How are you going to survive? Just stay here, even though it might be theirs." And I said, "No, Dad, please go together." And my dad said, "No." And then I had to cancel. I canceled twice. The person. But then when I turned 18, I said, "Okay, now I'm 18. They say if you are 18, you can make your own decision. I'm going to make my own decision. Then I made a decision, I apply, and went through the whole process by myself.
And what was the most difficult part for you when you're 19 years old, you arrive in Rochester, October of 2010? What was the hardest part for you, Carr?
Language.
And reminder, just get right close to your microphone. There you go.
Language was my huge, let's say my huge obstacle. I went to school and did not understand English. I came back home and did not understand. I had a hard time communicating with my landlord. Yeah, and transportation is my second problem. I had to go to grocery store. I had to go to the doctor's apartment, and I did not know how to use public bus. I did not know where to catch bus. So I remember I walked to one of the Asia store in Rochester here from my home to their store on my foot, barefoot. It took me 1 hour. So, yeah, all around that.
And when did you, was there a kind of a moment in your time in Rochester where you felt like you had overcome not just the language, but also understanding public transportation?
Yeah,
where's the
story? It took me a few months. And then I learned how to, where to catch the bus, and I read the street name. Yeah. And I graduated from high school here 1.5 year. Then, yeah,
It took you 1.5 years?
Yes.
And you graduated high school?
I was old enough.
Mm-hmm.
I was old enough, so.
What did you think of the American education system? How was school for you?
Awesome. Compared from refugee camp.
I love it. You said awesome. That's great.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Freedom. That's
good. And so now, what is life like for you now?
I'm doing okay. I'm happy. I can smile.
How has Rochester been? How do you describe Rochester to whether it's family or friends who might ask, is it a welcome community? How is it for refugees here?
I remember. So I left refugee camp October, maybe 24, 25, sometime. And I arrived here on October 26, 27. I got to the Rochester airport, and I had no idea where I would go. Then I met a case manager from CFC, and she had an interpreter with her, and they greeted me at the airport, and she took me to the apartment. She showed me, she showed me just like Paris, a new tower, and the bed was made already. Nice bed, purple color was my favorite, and nice rooms, and bathroom, all of the clean, kitchen, foods, and she opened the fridge, and all foods enough in the orange juice, milk, of course. I never see milk in the fridge. I mean, I do, but it's like here more like you. So, and I was like, wow. So I have all foods here, and chickens, and fruits, and my bed is ready, and bathroom, and paper, I mean, towels, and soap, everything. And I was like, wow. And it was so welcome, especially the landlord. American Lela, he was like my father, because I came here as a young girl and 19 years old, and he, even though I did not speak English, but he tried to teach me, like, make sure you don't go, and he kind of protected me just like my father. I just hope that he sees me and he heard me from this radio. I can never forget what they provide me, and they took good care of me till I graduated from high school. He was just like my father.
That's awesome.
And he is American. I'm just so happy.
We're going to close the week on a heavy but important note. Across the country, women are feeling more empowered to speak about the sexual harassment they've endured, or worse.
One reason women might hesitate to tell their stories is because critics have claimed they are either lying or trying to make money off of their experience. Erin Kate Howard is the co-founder of Lady Parts Theater in Rochester, and years ago, she was sexually assaulted. In this clip, she explains the pain and difficulty with coming forward, or in talking about it at all.
I was assaulted over 20 years ago, and it wasn't until probably 3 years ago that I really understood the impact that had on my life. That the trajectory of my life completely changed after that. And there's no amount of money that would have made that better. There's no amount of money that would have, you know, made me able to have relationships with people, or to, you know, not almost fail out of the program that I loved, or the impact of something like that. And I can't say that, I can't speak for all people and say that it's the same for every woman who's assaulted, but for me, it completely changed my life. And in some ways, I could say it ruined my life. In some ways, it felt like it. I feel like for me now, I found a way to channel that. But for people that really believe that a woman would come forward and share something so devastating to get some gain, it's just not worth it. To be ridiculed, to be questioned, to be, you know, and I didn't say anything to anybody for, I admitted parts of it, not admitted, I'd shared parts of it, but never like who it was. I couldn't say his name for 20 years. I couldn't even say his name out loud. I still can't, really. I wouldn't, you know, but the impact on your life, there's no reparation. You know, there's nothing that's going to heal that and take that away. And I think that, you know, that's the difference for, you know, Louis C.K. is going to go on and live his life. Does it suck for him? Probably. But for someone who's experienced something horrible, you don't get to, you know, go on and have some other life. It's there with you. You don't get to sort of magically remove it. And money's not going to change that, I guess. I don't know if I'm...
No, first of all, I admire you for even sharing what you've been through, and I'm sorry. I also don't even comprehend those who would claim that women would come forward with false allegations for some sort of monetary gain. Where is this magic money out there that I don't see? Yeah. Are there bags of cash that some cabal is giving to women for right. making accusations?
Right.
I mean... Right. I ask, I know it's flippant, but even, you know, Aaron, can I know what you went through? As you said, in some ways you can feel like it ruined parts of your life. And it's still difficult to talk about because there's nothing really that society doesn't really give much help or support, let alone money, right?
Right, right. Well, it's, I think everything is downplayed. Because it's so... normalized in a way. I was having a discussion with someone very close to me that I love who's male and talking about the Louis C.K. stuff and, you know, why didn't they just leave the room? Why didn't they, you know? I said, you know, from the time I was probably 12 years old, I felt like prey. And that's like, it's like you know, my first job, I would get cornered in the freezer. I was working in a restaurant and, you know, these grown men touching me because they thought they could get away with it. And it was terrifying. And you don't just, I can't even explain it, but it's like feeling like prey and walking, you know, down a street where I lived in New York and there was not a day I walked out that door that I wasn't harassed in some way by someone, and it is very, it's scary. I guess that's the only way to say it. It's scary, and when you're 14 years old, you're a child, and that's your, and you see that nobody will do anything. My boss wouldn't do anything. Nobody will do anything. So nobody will do anything. And every time something like that happened, nobody did anything. So when I was raped, nobody was going to do anything. You know. Because that person was going to be believed, because that person was, you know, somehow more important than me.
And that is another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, that's Finger Lakes Public Radio, all the way down to Ithaca, 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan. I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everyone. We will talk to you Monday.